Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Friday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, reactions to President Trump's proposed tariffs, plus Godzilla turned 65. Also, this week marks the unofficial start of summer, and from Memorial Day to Labor Day, we're changing things up here on the show. We'll be focusing on local and regional coverage with a one-hour program starting at 9, and please continue to tell us about things going on in your part of the valley. Email us at theshow@kjzz.org. And because it is just a one-hour show, it's a shock to my system as well. It's already time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We have spending needs. Rich people do not need any more help getting richer. It's not like they're going to try to buy every Tesla model, right? So there's only so much they can do with their money.
Here's where I stand philosophically. This is not our money. It belongs to the people. They earned it through blood, sweat, and tears. I get really irritated as political people. We think that the people's money and what they earn is ours, and we get so flippant about it.
We want to build a broad coalition with the task force so that we make certain that issues like this aren't swept under the rug, so that they're not forgotten or misappropriated.
I think John McCain had a lot to getting President Bush, a lot to do with it, to go into the Middle East, which was a catastrophe. To me, John McCain, I wasn't a fan, but I would never do a thing like that.
And with us to wrap up the 2019 legislative session, talk about a new Arizona Corporation Commissioner and more, are Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting and David Lujan of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Guys, welcome back.
Good to be
morning.
Here.
So, Stan, your president did something. Someone you've supported quite a bit, President Trump, has done
this
something.
This is how we're going to start, Steve, right? All right.
Has done something that seems to be upsetting the Arizona business community. These proposed tariffs on Mexico tied to immigration numbers. Why is he doing this at this point?
I think I accept what he says on face value, meaning he believes part of our problem is that Mexico is just not pulling its weight in this circumstance. I get the business community doing its thing. They're playing their role. That businesses hate tariffs. I get it. In my own mind, though, I think in the long game, this is not a bad thing. And this is what I analogize as medicine. We got to take our medicine. This is part of the pain of fixing the overall problem. It hits me as a surprise. I'm like every other American. I woke up and I went, well, really? What? But what a dramatic, bold move by this president.
But how is it directly tied, though, to high immigration numbers and to this tariff situation? Again, this is just one person's opinion. She's a Democrat, but we had Janet Napolitano in this week, and she said, yeah, the border's a concern, but it's not a concern that President Trump is making it out to be.
Yeah, I think she's wrong. I think the border is every bit the concern. I think there's a little bit of denial going on, and it's all wrapped in super politics and looking for constituencies and the like. Trump is a hard-edged guy, and this is a hard-edged business move. He's making the immigration thing Mexico's problem as well as our problem.
David?
Well, I think if you want to put a wet blanket on Arizona's economy, this is the way to do it. I think, you know, Arizona's economy is so tied to relations with Mexico, and this is going to impact all Arizonans if it happens. It's going to impact in jobs. It's going to impact in wages and in taxes that Arizonans pay. And, you know, the last I heard, Arizona was a swing state in 2020, and this is not going to help Trump's chances in Arizona if he goes forward with something like this.
So the business community we know is upset about this. We're going to hear from Glenn Hammer later in our show. But is this Trump playing to his base? I mean, is he concerned about that response, or is he concerned about the response from those people who really want him to do something on immigration?
Well, I think he's playing to his base. I think he's trying to come up with something that's going to make a difference. But, you know, this is a very complex problem, and I don't think that the increasing tariffs is going to be the answer. And like I said, the people who are going to pay are going to be the people in particularly the states that do a lot of business, a lot of trade with Mexico, and Arizona is one of the biggest.
Sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. Let's remember, Trump is not a politician. If you need a better example, this move is not a political move. This is a leverage New York developer businessman move. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I reward his bold thinking on the thing. And I see memes flying through the internet saying, all right, I guess Mexico is paying for the wall, things like that. So, yeah, I think the base is delighted by this whole deal. And some, thoughtful middle-of-the-road economists are giving him props for the, what I said, the long game on the tariffs. We've been done wrong in general. The Mexico thing is almost like taking the country hostage on this deal.
The most shocking thing you said is that you were on the internet, because I don't think I'll agree with that. So let's talk about someone who is a politician, and that is Governor Doug Ducey. And David, let me start with you on this. Governor Ducey has been, you know, to be kind, sort of lukewarm and not real strong on most things the president has said. He's trying to play both sides. Is he hurting the state the way he's reacted already to this? He hasn't come out more strongly. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I'm really surprised that he hasn't come out strong against this. It's been very lukewarm, like we've seen on most things like this. And you know, I'm surprised that he knows how Arizona can be hurt and how our economy is going to be hurt by these tariffs. And so we need him to be standing up strong against President Trump and telling him how much this is going to hurt Arizona. And it's a real shame that he hasn't done that yet.
Stan, does he need to do that?
I don't think so. I think he's a middle ground, moderate in tone kind of governor, steady handed. He's not out there to score a big social media or general media point.
Are there political considerations, though, for him? Because there shouldn't be. This is a guy talking about broad support. His base, if he has a base, is pretty wide. He was one Republican who won handily. I mean, is this about his future prospects, or does he really sort of not know what to say here?
No, I think I give him credit for seeing the problem from both sides. I think the governor believes the border problem is a real problem, and the governor believes the president is acting boldly. He may not agree with that, but it's a difficult circumstance for a Republican governor. Let's give it that. If you're trying to stand in the balance point like Doug Ducey's doing. But I think he's doing right with it in terms of balancing the constituency viewpoint.
How does this end up playing in Arizona, though? We talked about Trump's base and then the business community, right? But like Ducey, like Steve said, was elected by, you know, a pretty good majority here, but on, I would say, like a pretty strong business Republican platform. Does this go against that brand?
A little bit. But I think my analogy on this is it's kind of like sales taxes. The reason everyone thinks they can raise sales taxes is because no one directly feels it or can quantify it. The tariff thing is very similar. Do you want to do something bold about illegal immigration? Yes. And the tariff thing for most people is abstract, and they'll never feel it. They can't quantify it. The Arizona Chamber of Commerce will tell you, we got to put up the flag. This is a big, bad thing. But no one average can. I can't. I'm average. I can't quantify what the tariff thing means to me. Maybe if I was back in the cotton farming business in Pinal County, I could. But most people aren't. Most people are just living their lives.
But I think they will feel it if they start to lose jobs, if they start to see the price of goods going up. And I think there's a real danger of that happening. And if that happens, then I do think it could impact politically, like I mentioned. I mean, we've got presidential election in 2020, you have a big election, and it's not just this, but then you also, I think we're going to talk about the McCain ship, that Later issue, on, yeah. And just, you know, how the president is taking some actions that really will, I think, negatively impact the perspectives of some Arizonans.
All right, my awkward segue from that, the news of the day, to the legislative session, which now feels like ancient history, which ended early Monday morning.
Goodness, so
yeah,
long ago.
Yeah. So, Stan, I don't know if there are winners and losers from this. The education community, and David, I wanted you to address this as well, obviously. There were some, and Governor Ducey did make some advances, did follow up on what he did with the last legislative session. But why, and maybe this is just the Republican versus Democratic philosophy, why more important to put more money in the rainy day fund than put more money in education? Because isn't that in some ways naively putting the rainy day fund, making it less important if you have more people who are educated.
I think some of our Democratic friends see it that way. I think what Doug Ducey sees and the Republican legislature is what happened when your guest, Janet Napolitano, was last governor, where when she left and went to work for the Obama administration, the economy cratered. Arizona lost one-third of its revenue and no money in the bank, essentially. We had spent money in the good times, raised the baseline of the budget.
But even our friend Bob Robb has said, though, how big would the rainy day fund have had to be to counter that?
Fair enough. I think the rainy day fund is one of the parts of the equation. The other part is allowing the budget of the state to float up during good times. And that's when I heard Doug Ducey speak about it. He said, we can't let that happen. So I give him credit for that. It feels good to spend the money when you have it. But in state governance, once you raise that floor, all of a sudden, that's the new floor. And everybody thinks it's a cut if growth doesn't come. So this was a temperate conservative budget. And Republicans are running the state. That's the reflection of that.
But David, education, a lot of people are still wondering, how about a few hundred more million or something like
right.
that?
Right. Well, when you talk about that floor, the problem is that floor for public education and a lot of other things in Arizona is still below 2008 levels. It's still below where we were over a decade ago. And for us, it's not so much choosing between the rainy day fund and education. It was more choosing between tax cuts, a $386 million tax cuts, worth of tax cuts versus putting more money into education and other priorities. And I think that is what really overshadowed this budget. There were some good things that were in the budget, but that $386 million worth of tax cuts, I think, is really fiscally irresponsible. And going back to Governor Napolitano, the last time we had a $386 million income tax cut like that was 2006. Just like this year, we had a $1 billion budget surplus. And then so the legislature that year did a huge income tax cut. The next year, the recession began. 2 years later, Arizona had a $1 billion budget deficit, and we were facing the largest cuts to public education in state history. So I think what a lot of people in the education community were really looking for is, rather than having those tax cuts, let's put that money into our schools, our universities, our community colleges, all of those things that are still below 2008 funding levels. And one thing I'll add, too, it's not like in 2008 we were, you know, doing well. We were in the bottom 10 in education funding back in 2008. So just to get to there, it's a big road.
And as many education leaders have pointed out this week, like, we are still among the lowest in the country in terms of per pupil funding. There was a new report out yesterday, I think, that still had us at 49th in the country for teacher pay. I want to ask a question about the legacy of Red for Ed here. I mean, you talk to education leaders, they'll say this is still happening. There were still teachers down there, a couple dozen in their red shirts on the last day when they were voting on the budget, but they were unhappy from what I heard talking to them afterward. Do you think that they were a non-factor this time? Do you think that they need to change approaches next time around?
Yeah, I do. They were a non-factor. They had their moment the year before, and they had the biggest moments we've ever seen politically. They got a lot in that deal. They flipped the governor from a 1% pay raise to a 20% pay raise, and that's happening. And this year, when they went down to kind of try to recreate the magic, it just wasn't there. Even our Democratic friends couldn't hand them that kind of political love because they got more than anyone else in some time.
So did we overstate the 31-29 House split then? I guess a lot of us thought, it's going to make such a difference. It didn't seem to.
Yeah. Stan and I were talking before that, at the beginning of this session, I think we all thought that with a 31-29, the holdup would be ultimately in the House. But really, it was more in the Senate. And I think the one thing you have to say about this legislature, both caucuses, no matter how much fighting they seemed to be doing during session, when it came down to budget time, the two caucuses stayed very united. You saw the 31 Republicans in the House stuck together, and you saw all the Democrats stick together as well. And so that, I think, was a little bit surprising.
Yeah, I think that was the surprise. All the even money betting among, railbirds was the Republicans were going to split. I mean, the personalities, the money in the checkbook, you know. Fighting with the governor from the get-go over the conformity thing. But it was a miracle that they brought those 31 together, honestly.
That is Stan Barnes. Also here is David Lujan in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. We are in the midst of the Friday newscap. We'll talk Arizona Corporation Commission right after this. It's the Friday newscap here on the show with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Getting back to Stan Barnes and David Lujan in just a moment. But some major Corporation Commission news happened yesterday, surprising a lot of us. And here to tell us more about that is Ryan Randazzo of the Arizona Republic. Ryan, good morning.
Morning.
So did you see this coming in any way? I was thinking about the recent time we had you on talking about whether APS's books need to be looked into more, this 4-1 vote. Andy Tobin was on the side of the four. Was there any indication Tobin was not long for this job?
Well, there was indication that he was pretty frustrated with the job. I was definitely surprised that he resigned and took another job within the administration. But, you know, reflecting on it, especially the last meeting, I mean, he's really been at odds with the other commissioners, oddly, you know, at odd with the other Republicans on the commission. They just can't seem to agree on anything. Even when they're on the same side of an issue, they can't decide how to address it. And there's just a lot of personality politics on the commission. So, no, I don't think it's that surprising that he wasn't happy, although it's a very difficult time for a new person, I think, to come onto that board.
So let's talk about the new person who's coming onto that board, Leah Marquez Peterson, a longtime Tucson businesswoman. Tell us a little bit about her and what you think she might do here. Ryan, you there?
Well, that question, Lauren, was so harsh. So now we're back to Stan Barnes and David Lujan. So, guys, let's get reaction as far as that goes when it comes down to, oh, Ryan is back. Okay. Hey, Ryan, you still there? Well, all right, Ryan. I think live radio has gotten us again. Stan, let's go to what Lauren was talking about. Do you know Leah Marquez Peterson? I know her only from moderating a debate in Tucson when she was going up against Ann Kirkpatrick.
Yeah, I know her more by reputation, but I have met her a few times as well. She seems gracious, dignified, civic-minded. She ran a campaign for Congress. She lost. No harm in that, though, having lived that life myself. Thank you. The best person doesn't always win. That's what I say. But she ended up conducting herself very well. She's well-reputed within Republican circles.
But, David, one concern some folks have already expressed is that APS gave some money to her congressional campaign. And, of course, we've seen issues before. Folks were concerned about APS, quote-unquote, buying a couple of seats. Does that background concern you?
Yeah, it concerns me. And I think, as Ryan was mentioning, she comes in at a very difficult time. And you know, APS is obviously going to be very front and center. And so it'd be nice, hopefully, she'll come in and she'll be, you know, impartial and she'll come in and learn and not come in with any sort of agenda or be, you know, beholden in any way towards APS. I don't think she will be, but that is a concern when you have somebody who has been affiliated with them in that way before.
This comes, like you said, at this really critical moment on the CorpCom and for APS in terms of, you know, the looking at how much money they are making, how much money their CEO is making. I wonder if either of you can weigh in this would have been a good question for Ryan, too. But give us a sense of whether or not you think bringing in another person with this particular background, with a business background, will change the game here, will change this conversation.
I don't think it will. I think her and Andy Tobin are different personalities, but probably won't be that different in policy at that very narrow but deep policy place called the Arizona Corporation Commission. It's a numbers-driven, math-driven kind of thing. There is some overarching policy in renewable energy and that sort of thing, but when it comes to what the utility that's regulated is going to earn on its rate of return. I mean, that's kind of to the right of the decimal point kind of stuff. And so I think she's just going to blend in with that that middle ground Republican steady-handed thing that is trying to go on there.
Yeah, that would be my hunch too. I don't know Leah Marquez, but I know Andy Tobin. I served with him in the legislature, and from what I know of the two, what I've heard of Leah, I think ideologically and kind of, you know, philosophically, they're kind of very similar. And mm-hmm. So I don't think there's going to be too much difference in terms of that, how they approach things. But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
You know, they're kind of a quasi-judicial thing, right? They don't get to do what legislators do, which is take each other in the corner and say, how are you going to vote on this? They don't do that. That's part of what really frustrated Andy Tobin, because he's still a Speaker of the House. As he told me, he's a fish out of water at the Corporation Commission. I agree with that.
He keeps trying to find a place where he'll fit in.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Well, guys, one other quick thing on this topic, and that is that some people have speculated about, I'm sure it won't happen because it leads to constitutional change, but should a position like this be appointed by the governor? Should it be someone that needs more expertise in this particular area? Because it seems like a pretty complicated thing rather than just a lawmaker stepping up to the next position.
I do think that somebody who's in that position should have some background or some expertise in this. I think, I think it's a kind of a very niche kind of role. I don't think any politician can just run for that. I've had people talk to me in the past about running for a corporation commission. I said, that's not my area. It's not my. And so I really think to do a good job, you have to have a little bit of background.
So you're clearly not a politician anymore.
A state that elects its mine inspector is going to continue to elect its corporation commissioners.
Because there has been talk about not doing this in an elected form. One last question about this. So last week, I think it was just last week, Bob Burns, who's now the chair of the commission, who's been a big APS critic, brought up the idea of deregulation, of allowing utilities like APS to compete for customers with other utilities. Any sense of whether that is a real idea at this point? It's been talked about many times in the past.
Yeah, you're right. Your listeners should know I'm involved in that issue. Mm-hmm. On the pro side, I help some of the larger customers who are interested in shopping for their power. They have been for 20-something years. And you're right. We did have it, and then it went away.
Yeah.
All the fun went out of it when Enron happened and California went dark. But there is some optimism among folks, and there's a kind of a weird coalition happening between mm-hmm. renewable energy advocates and large customers, sophisticated customers. And they've combined to say, let us out. Let us choose, because a lot of things will happen in a positive way. You'll get more renewable energy development. You'll get more cost-competitive pricing on electricity, which will lead to jobs and economic development and that sort of thing. I think we're going to get something to happen, and this summer it's going to play out.
I don't know much about that issue, but I think it sounds good. I mean,
there it is right there.
Stan has convinced me.
So we're back to President Trump. We started the segment with President Trump. David, we're back to President Trump now. Why does Donald Trump what is this with John McCain? What is going on there?
I don't know. It's it seems like every time I'm on the show, we're talking about something like this. And, it is, I think it's childish. It's just bad behavior that you want to see. And, he said, well, it wasn't me, it was my administration. But, the White House, the administration really sets the tone for the rest of the country. And every time we hear of one of these things about President Trump, it makes me always think about where we're going as a country. And I always think about that old classic movie, A Wonderful Life. And in that movie, they have like the idyllic American town that's Bedford Falls, but then they show what would happen when you've got this leader who is, very self-interested and selfish and mean-spirited, and then they create this, Pottersville. And I think, the example that we're seeing from the president of other people emulate that. Other, children, and it's not just children, it's adults. And so I just feel sad every time I see that I feel like our country is becoming more and more like Pottersville every day.
Stan, I think that's a great analogy, but let me come back to something a little bit more specific on this, which is this a case where the president does set the tone, and maybe his staffers don't necessarily want to do these things, but they feel like got to please the boss, and then the backlash is not so great.
Yeah, I don't know what really happened on the McCain ship thing. I mean, I've been trying to absorb the information coming at me from the different news channels. I really can't tell you what happened. I know there's a controversy. I don't know if it's manufactured or not, but having said that, this petty side of this president is distasteful for most everybody, including me, a guy who voted for him, a guy who likes what he's doing. If I could magically remove that from him, we'd carve his face on Mount Rushmore. But instead, he's so hard to defend. He's so hard to love for most Americans. There is a big slice that is so delighted by the fact that he's non-political, and this is proof of it. But other than that, I wish he wouldn't do these sort of things. But I love his bold moves, and I love the way the economy's humming as well.
One question about this that's a little broader for both of you is this idea that a lot of folks are writing about, even on the national scale right now, of people, including Amy Klobuchar and the Democratic presidential pool, people are trying to sort of jockey for John McCain's legacy, right? Like, who owns it? Who gets to claim what he stood for and how they're going to carry it forward? What do you both think about that? I mean, obviously, it's a difficult one, and Meghan McCain seems to be the one who steps in every time and says, stop doing this. But it doesn't seem to be stopping.
Yeah, it is. That's subtle but important politics in a narrow but important universe of people that are kind of running the country. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting for us as Arizonans to see that play out, isn't it? It's even mm-hmm. happening kind of on the ground in Arizona, too, with Martha McSally doing her best to be in both places at one time on the John McCain legacy. He wasn't loved by all Republicans in Arizona. We all know that. And so it's a complicated thing. It's really interesting that post-mortem, we're still talking about him as a political figure and its impact, his impact.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't agree with a lot of things that John McCain did, but I think, you know, very few people can argue with the fact that he was an American hero and just, you know, what he did for our country. And so I think you're seeing people that are fighting to make sure that you know, piece of John McCain is not trampled on, and particularly here in Arizona, we feel very strongly about that. I think, you know, a lot of us see John McCain as our Arizona hero, and you know, I think it's dangerous for President Trump if he wants to be successful in Arizona in 2020. We talked about the tariffs earlier, but you know, regardless of whether you like his politics or not, John McCain's. People in Arizona, I think, for the most part, see him as a very positive figure, as a hero. And so I don't think it's in President Trump's best interest to continue to trash him.
Let's take our final few minutes of the newscap and talk about another very political issue. It is Robert Mueller. And Stan, you'll say this is probably politics as usual, which is okay. But David, Greg Stanton has come out and said he would now be in favor of impeachment proceedings. And I was thinking, you know, that used to be a district that was seen as sort of a swing district. I guess it isn't anymore. I guess it's Democratic enough. Mm-hmm. Is this a political calculation by Greg Stanton, or do you think he really believes at this point, got to go forward?
I actually really do think that, you know, I was actually in D.C. last week, and I had an opportunity to have a conversation with Congressman Stanton about this very issue. And he was not decided at that point. He was really struggling and really going through and mm-hmm. trying to think about, you know, what his position was on this issue. He has a very important spot on the Judiciary Committee. And so, you know, to see him come out with that statement yesterday, I was a little surprised because last week he hadn't. But I do think that the Mueller statement earlier this week had an impact on him. I know that he was looking through the report and really, and I think a lot of Democrats are doing that. You know, I think for Democrats, they know what the political cost is if they proceed with impeachment. But I think now they're starting to see what's the political cost if we don't do that. And so I think in Greg's case, it's not I think, and with a lot of Democrats, they're not doing this in a partisan way. They're really taking time to think about it. And I think at some point, the political cost is going to shift. You know, we all assume that when it gets to the Senate, Republican senators are not going to vote to impeach. But then I think there's going to be a cost to them as well, because I think if the House Democrats put on a very strong case to show that impeachment is necessary, and the Senate Republicans do not follow that, I think that people in 2020 are going to really question why some Senate Republicans are not going forward with impeachment.
So stand risks on both sides?
Yeah,
or no?
Did you ask if this was a political calculation?
I know, I try to keep my naivete down.
Is this your first day on the radio?
Yeah.
Of course it is. And
but wholly political.
But I think it's 99, it's like ivory soap political.
So David didn't convince you at all?
No, he didn't convince me. I'll give Greg Stanton the props for acting authentically. But a miscalculation, of course, in my opinion. I think the whole thing is about bruising Donald Trump up because they can't beat him with whatever candidate is so far left to win the Democratic nomination. And so the big overarching calculus is to bruise him so badly that they can beat him in 2020. One more thing. I've been dying to say this. Can you imagine if the report actually connected a line between the president and being guilty? If it used the word guilty, like Ken Starr said Bill Clinton was guilty, what if Mueller said he was guilty? Right now, Mueller's giving us a big ball of mush that you could translate any way you wish. But what if he actually said guilty? Because right now, the doors feel like they're blowing off Washington. We're going to impeach this president over this big ball of mush. What if he said guilty. I mean, the dome would pop off the Capitol. There'd be so much heat going on there.
David, we've got 20 seconds left.
Well, and I think that the Democrats, I think, are really taking time. I don't think the ball of heat is blowing off of the Capitol in Washington. I think, if it was, we'd already see them moving towards impeachment. I think they're being very deliberative and as non-political as this process can be. But it is always going to be political when you're talking about impeachment.
David Lujan of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Former state lawmaker, former congressional candidate, Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting. Guys, thanks. This is the show on 91.5 KJZZ. Thanks for being with us this morning. With Lauren Gilger, I'm Steve Goldstein. And we're doing things a bit differently this summer. From 9 until 10, from now until Labor Day, we're focusing on the stories of the state and the takeaways coming up from 10 until 11 as we follow this summer schedule.
Next to our next story is about, of course, the Mexico tariffs that the president has threatened. We mentioned earlier in the newscap, in an attempt to deter the number of asylum-seeking families from Central America that are coming to the U.S. through Mexico, President Trump said last night he would impose a 5% tariff on Mexican imports. And joining us for a few minutes to discuss what that will mean for the economies of the U.S. and here in Arizona is Glenn Hammer with the Arizona Commerce or Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
So you sent out a pretty strongly worded statement as soon as this was released. Were you surprised?
I was shocked. It's a terrible idea. Here we are. We've made tremendous progress in the movement of a new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, the USMCA. We consider it maybe the best trade agreement ever negotiated in the history of the United States. And here we have this very misguided tariff imposed out of left field by the president that's maybe legally dubious that could blow this whole thing up.
Glenn, what do Arizona political leaders need to do here, whether it's Senator Sinema and McSally, whether it's Governor Ducey? People have been disappointed by the governor's response, saying that he sort of seems like he wants to play it both ways.
No, I want to make this very clear. There is no better champion in terms of the relationship with Mexico and Arizona than Governor Doug Ducey. When you take a look at the increased trading numbers, that they were up 7-8% to over $16 billion last year, that is a direct result of Governor Doug Ducey's work. He's working this in a way so that, you know, he is a voice, I'm sure, that is very constructive for the state of Arizona when he's dealing with the White House. I run the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. I could tell you from an economic standpoint, this will be damaging. This is a terrible idea. It's a tax on consumers and will also has the potential to rupture supply chains in key industries in Arizona, including emerging industries such as the auto sector.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, Stan Barnes said during our newscap last half hour, was about this idea that Mexico, I guess, will pay for the wall now, right? Like, this is the president doing what he said he would do. This, from your point of view, sounds like it will hurt Arizona.
It will hurt everyone. Tariffs are taxes. It's a polite way to say taxes. And they're even worse because they could come out of like this particular one out of left field. I'll tell you what needs to happen. Senator Sinema has been talking about her effort with Senator Portman, a Republican from Ohio, to rein in the national security tariffs. This is going to need to obviously be a broader congressional exercise. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican who generally supports the administration on immigration matters, questioned publicly the appropriateness of these tariffs. And I'll also make another point. Mexico is a friend and ally of the United States. We need to work cooperatively with Mexico to deal with the asylum issue.
One thing we also talked about last half hour on the newscap was this idea that people won't really feel it. This is like a murky idea that if it's tariffs, it's like a sales tax, is what Stan said. I wonder, do you think this will really hit home for people, though?
This will hit home across the board. This is going to make our manufacturing less competitive. But I'll tell you what will go into the bloodstream immediately is you're going to see an increase in prices to everyday things that we take for granted. Avocado toast, that's how I start my day.
The delicious, of course
you do. Oh, yeah. With a side of delicious tomatoes imported through Nogales, grown in Mexico. We're going to see an increase in those prices immediately. And after some of these types of activities, I may try to end the night with a little drink of tequila. That's going to go up as well. So we're going to feel this instantly.
Glenn, last one for me, though. What you're saying is very, very strong. You've come out before against tariffs. And yet, this president is so unpredictable. Does he have advisors from the economic standpoint saying to him, okay, threats are okay, but you can't follow through on these?
Well, let's take a look at what's happening on the market. And I have no idea who's advising him internally. Tariffs are taxes. And at a time where we are engaged in a trade battle with China, we should be doubling down on building our alliances with our friends. So all of this energy should be from the administration working with the business community to try to get the USMCA, the new trade agreement, through the United States Congress, not imposing punitive tariffs on our friend and ally, Mexico, that Arizonans and Americans are going to pay for. It's a dumb way to go about trade or immigration policy, in our view, respectfully.
Strong words from Glenn Hammer with the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry. Glenn, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
The Arizona legislature adjourned Tuesday morning, and that means several bills died before they could get a formal vote.
Among these was an effort to change how schools teach English language learners. Under current Arizona law, students learning English as a second language are not allowed to be taught in their native language. A House resolution would have repealed the so-called English-only law here in Arizona and allow native English speakers and English language learners to be taught side by side. That would have been sent to voters. That proposal was given preliminary approval in the Senate by lawmakers from both parties, but the session ended before it could receive a formal vote, according to the Arizona Mirror.
Bills about vaping went up in smoke. One proposal to raise the age to 21 for purchasing tobacco and vaping products didn't have the votes, and another that would have classified vaping products as tobacco, which had support from public health advocates, didn't make it through.
Monday night, the Senate voted down a bill that would give $2.5 million to services that discourage pregnant women from getting abortions. Two Republicans joined the Democrats to kill the measure.
One law that was sent to Governor Ducey's desk at the end of the session and awaits the governor's signature is House Bill 2358, which allows landlords to evict renters who receive Section 8 housing.
The bill's supporters said that landlords are not allowed to evict people on domestic violence complaints if they use public housing assistance to pay for their rent. But its critics say landlords would be able to evict tenants simply for using housing vouchers.
Overall, the legislature passed nearly 300 bills. We can imagine we'll see some of these issues come to light again in the next session.
For 2 years, Frontline producer Lauren Mucciolo embedded with the Phoenix Police Department's Vice Enforcement Unit as they work to tackle the growing problem of sex trafficking in America for her new documentary, Sex Trafficking in America. The experience left her with a new realization of the scope of the industry and just how easy it can be for young girls to get pulled into it as social media's influence rises.
Once they friend me on Facebook, then I just go into their friend list and I just hit them all up with friend requests.
Some of them, they quit 24 and they're actually 15.
I have never, ever met a trafficker that I felt sorry for. I mean, they're literally selling humans day in and day out and making money off of them.
I spoke with Mucciolo more about the experience of making that film and why she chose Phoenix to focus on.
We would spend, you know, several weeks at a time over those 2.5 years being a part of their work daily life. So whether that meant they were doing operations, whether that meant they were in the office working on paperwork, whether that meant they were doing bookings because an operation had, you know, completed and now they had 7 people to book, we were there for all of it. We were there as they were organizing and thinking up operations. We saw how they innovated over time as, you know, the trafficking landscape changed. They tried new things. So we were really, you know, given this amazing access and privilege to be a part of those inside conversations, which I think is very unusual for an undercover unit. But they really trusted us and trusted that we would get the story right.
Can you give us an example of some of the kinds of things that you witnessed? I mean, being a part of this, this is such a difficult topic, sex trafficking, human trafficking. You know, what were some of the experiences that will stick with you?
Well, there are a lot of experiences that will stick with us. We saw a lot of different sides of the way they approach this issue. So we saw their contact with some of the young women on the street. And what was really striking about those interactions was that these cops really made an effort to get to know these people, to try to connect with them, to build rapport, even times where we saw them run into the same young woman several times on the street. It was really about building rapport and building relationships, and that seemed like a really unique approach. And then on the other side of that, when they would deal with customers, they did a lot of operations that focused on dealing with the buyers. And those operations were really impressive because you really saw just about every walk of life walk into those hotel rooms or try to, you know, solicit the cops undercover on the street. You saw young men, you saw old men, you saw people who were clearly from, you know, more of a blue collar or working class background. You saw people who were clearly, you know, high up the food chain, possibly CEOs of major companies. So that was really eye opening to see how many different kinds of men are looking to buy sex.
Why did you choose Phoenix? I mean, what led you to this city and this particular unit?
So we spent a lot of time in the beginning of our research talking to experts in the sort of national arena and being introduced to different units in different parts of the country that, you know, we could possibly get access. And so we spent time really talking to a lot of different folks. And what was really unique about Phoenix is that they have an incredibly proactive unit, and they have great relationships with the other service providers who work in this field. So they don't work in a silo. They don't have, you know, bad relationships with some of the folks that provide services to victims, or they're not at odds with the prosecution or in the county attorney's office. They really are very, very plugged in and have great relationships. So to make a film on an issue like this in Phoenix, it was really important for us to be able to move seamlessly between working with the police and then going to work with one of the service providers, one of the housing facilities for survivors of trafficking, then to be able to move as well into the court system. So being able to capitalize on the relationships that already existed and all of the sort of good feeling between those different groups was a real benefit. And then, of course, the Phoenix Vice Unit is really, really, I think, at the front lines of dealing with this issue. They've been thinking about it and reshaping the way they approach this issue over time. So they've, I think, really developed a very, very progressive and effective unit.
A lot of the talk about sex trafficking and human trafficking is about the border, but that is not always the case, right? Like, does Phoenix stand out in some way?
You know, the whole idea of the border, when we're talking about human trafficking, I think becomes a little bit misleading. What we found when we were on the ground in a border state working with the police is that by and large, the victims that we came across were American born and bred girls. And by and large, a lot of the traffickers we came across were American born and bred. So what we saw on the ground did not really reflect some of the tropes that you hear in society about what this issue looks like. So that was surprising, and that was a really important finding. I think that what people don't understand about human trafficking is that it happens everywhere. It happens in big cities, it happens in small towns, it happens in the suburbs. You know, one thing about Phoenix is that it is on a lot of different highways that, you know, sort of cross over. So it does have a hub feature in that respect. But other than that, you know, trafficking is something that happens all over the country. And I think it's really important that the public starts to recognize that.
So embedding with these detectives for this amount of time, you really, I'm sure, got to know them. I wonder, like, what kind of effect does this have on them dealing with this industry that's so difficult for so long?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important thing to think about, because it's often we don't. The police spend a lot of time out in the field doing this work, and it takes a toll. They see people, you know, with some of the victims and survivors they've dealt with. They've seen people go through all of the changes, you know, folks who seem to be doing well, and then, you know, something happens and they kind of take a dip again. That has an emotional impact on the detectives. The hours they put in, I mean, they work overtime, they're on standby. It takes a big toll on their families. We filmed with a lot of women in this unit, and they were all moms. They all had young kids at home. And so that's, you know, that's a big sacrifice. But the amount of work that they put into it, and I guess that kind of unique sensibility that they were able to bring to this as, you know, being moms, being, you know, even with the detectives who were men, a lot of them are dads. That sensibility, I think, really goes a long way.
Yeah. All right. Lauren Mucciolo is the producer of the new Frontline documentary, Sex Trafficking in America. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sixty-five years ago, one of the most iconic movie monsters was created, emerging from Japan's nuclear fallout. His name is Godzilla.
In 1954, we awakened something.
Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
For thousands of years, these creatures have remained in hiding around the world.
You have no idea what's coming.
Run! It's Godzilla!
And after all those decades impacting pop culture, including some stops and starts, Godzilla returns in the new film that opens today, Godzilla, King of the Monsters. And with me to talk about the character's continued impact and popularity is Deborah Deacon, faculty associate at ASU's School of Art. Deborah, let's talk about Godzilla's specific origins first. And does it have any connection to ancient Japanese stories or legends, or is the character completely related to the aftermath of World War II?
Because Godzilla is a dinosaur, probably not. There's probably no real tie to historical Japanese mythologies. Japanese have mythologies about dragons, flying dragons, monsters, especially in the realm of Buddhism, and the ideas of hells and things like that. But Godzilla really comes out of the tradition of atomic bomb literature, which is a whole thing started by some of those who, from Nagasaki and Hiroshima, authors initially, who wrote about their experiences. That expanded to the film industry, but not until after the American occupation of Japan ended. During the American occupation, there really was no public discourse on the fact that they were bombed, what happened, the people who were impacted by radiation were kind of put in a corner and not talked about in the greater Japanese society. But they wrote, and then they started making films. And actually, Honda, who was the director for the first Godzilla, the 1954 Gojira movie, was a witness to Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So this film comes out of kind of the whole Japanese psyche of we've been bombed, anti-nuke, you know, the fear of this technology. And that's very prevalent in that 1954 film. You see a lot. It's an adult film. It was not made for children. Mm-hmm. It was that adult film, the fear of the nuclear bomb. And when Gojira starts attacking, it's that, oh, is this happening again? All this radiation, a lot of talk about radiation. The actors are very much afraid and fearful through the whole movie.
Did the character embody not just fear, but also a combination of hero and villain? Was it a complicated aspect?
He was perhaps a sympathetic villain. He was not a hero in this movie. I mean, he lays waste to Tokyo and to the little island where they launched their investigation from. But he kills people. He doesn't eat anybody. He's getting his energy from the electricity and electrical wires. He's breathing his atomic fire. But he's on a rampage against technology and against essentially modernity, I guess you could say. It's not until, let's see, he came out in 54. The American version comes out in 56, the spring of 56. But in the late 1955, the first revival of Godzilla happens. And in that movie, he starts to move more towards the heroic. So by the time he's in the late 50s with Rodan and then 61 with Mothra, he's now a hero. He's defending Tokyo against an invader.
Do people have to have that knowledge of Godzilla to understand that? Or was Godzilla, people who were just, let's say, casual fans, was he seen as, oh, this is just another monster movie?
I think he's just another monster movie. And if you watch the 1954 original Gojira, and then you watch the 56 with Raymond Burr, a lot of what they cut out is the average Japanese person wringing their hands and being in agony, because that's told from a reporter's looking back on what happened and the destruction rather than actually experiencing it as it happened. I think today the average viewer who saw, which like I did as a kid, all those Mothra and Rodan and all the, you know, the crazy movies of the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s, Godzilla's a hero.
Godzilla, clearly, as you said, iconic in right. Japan. That Absolutely. Cannot be overstated. How did Godzilla become almost iconic, or if not iconic, very close to it in America?
Well, I think it's partially the 1956 movie with Raymond Burr. And I think that was one of those monsters we had never seen before. And of course, in the 50s, you start having the Men in the Rubber Suits, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and all those kinds of movies, which for 9, 10, 11-year-olds was a big deal. And so there's been that all along. But he's always been there. I mean, they stopped making movies in the early 70s, but you have Blue Oyster Cult, who comes out with a song called Godzilla. Charles Barkley making a Nike commercial with Godzilla. You've got, you know, all of these things that keep him in our minds. The toy stores all have the Godzilla models, even when the movie wasn't around. And then every once in a while, they make a new movie. He's almost a cultural touchstone for this idea that bad things happen, but there's always a hero. And it doesn't have to be a superhero or a man mm-hmm. or a woman. It can be something like an animal.
Deborah Deacon is a faculty associate at ASU School of Art. Godzilla, King of the Monsters, stomps into theaters around the country today. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.